Today, our first bit of discussion is going to be to review the Fischer stereochemistry proof. Because as I was commenting on during the lab lecture, I know that many of you now have dived in to start reading about it. How many of you have tried reading the version that's in the handout that I emailed? Oh, because it's too wordy, or you've just been too busy to read it yet? The second one? Okay. I admit it is a little bit overload. It's a little much detail, but I thought having a more rich presentation might be accidentally interesting to some of you. So, do give it a read through at some point, because I would not mind some feedback on it for the next crop of students. But this proof effectively had 6 points to it, one of which I call the zeroth point, because it's something that had to be discovered, but something that we start with as a working assumption, that glucose is an aldohexose. So, getting that out of the way, though, what are the 5 other steps in the way that I presented this proof? What's the first one? The last stereocenter is a guess. So, what specific molecule can we refer to tell clearly what the difference between a D and an L sugar is? For the last one, but as far as a specific sugar, what would be the best example of a sugar to use and say, here's the D version, here's the L version? And I know that's a subjective question. But I didn't ask what is the meaning of something being D or L. I asked what is the best example sugar to show whether something is D or L. D-talism. Okay, I can understand that because you've got all of the... Well, no, you don't have all of them. They're on opposite sides. Why not glyceraldehyde, right? The molecule that the only difference between the D and L forms is that they're enantiomers. The point of bringing that up as the example of a D and L sugar is, well, in the very second step, we talk about the Kilioni-Fischer chain extension. The fact that we can make some kind of stereochemical relationship between a smaller sugar and a larger sugar that it's able to produce. But for step one, that wouldn't be so much the focus. The focus would be on the fact that you can create larger sugars from smaller ones, and that if the simplest sugar of all, glyceraldehyde, that compound is used to establish what is D or L, then all of the larger sugars can be synthesized from it, which is why they're also called D and L. So you were all correct. Yes, what is D and what is L is determined by the position of that last stereocenter, but I just want to emphasize that it is because of glyceraldehyde that determination is made, and that the chemical reactivity of all the sugars is determined by the rest of the stereocenters, effectively, not that last one. Does that make sense, that extra detail I was trying to put in on that? Now, I'm going to warn you ahead of time that since most of what I'm mentioning today will be a repeat of the various places I mentioned these things before, I'm not going to write down anything today except possibly some structure so we're not just staring at space, or anything new that I might add to the discussion. But these points I've brought up before, so I'll just make sure and ask one more time if anybody has any questions about what we just discussed. Point, excuse me, one on the Fischer proof. Right, so you just shared with us point one. Would someone like to discuss the second point of the proof? Glucose and mannose are epimers, that's right. And what 2 ways do we have to know that that is the case? So you can synthesize both of them from arabinose, which besides the fact that glucose and mannose are epimers, the importance there is that the 3 stereocenters that are in arabinose are automatically the 3 stereocenters of those larger sugars. Because it is by adding only 1 stereocenter that you make glucose and mannose. What's the other way that we know that they're epimers? What you said is actually enough, but I did talk about a second way to know that they're epimers. And what's the name of that derivative? That's the chain extension. Remember, the way to remember is it's a sugar derivative, so os, that same sugar term that shows up everywhere, and it's a hydrazone derivative, so it's an osazone. So those osazone derivatives, which, by the way, someone asked me yesterday, and your handout, is it really three equivalents that react of that phenylhydrazine? Yes, because there's a redox reaction that, if you've seen the mechanism, you know that one of those equivalents causes. And it's, again, that interesting or that unusual reactivity of the nitrogen-nitrogen single bond that ends up causing that. Side story, though. So the osazones, though, you get the same exact one from both glucose and mannose. And that's because the bottom three stereocenters of the two sugars don't get disturbed when making an osazone, but the top stereocenter does. And since that's the only stereocenter that differentiates between glucose and mannose, that's how we can demonstrate that they are epimers, because once you get rid of that difference, they form the same derivative. Any questions on step two, then, of the proof? Most of you are looking at me like, well, that's a lot of detail, but no, I heard that, and that kind of makes sense. Okay. So how about point three, where things start to get a little stickier? No pun intended. Yes? Arabinic acid is optically active, and could you explain to me a way that you could show with as little writing or thought as possible what the consequence of that is?
So the molecules that you're dealing with and the
okay, and so what type of molecule should I write down to have this discussion? Okay, so HCN is the Kiliani-Fischer chain extension. You said arabinic acid, which is the correct compound. Arabinic acid is what kind of sugar derivative? An aldaric acid, which is synthesized how? From nitric acid, that's right. So nitric acid, which I told the other section this. I actually did put some time into trying to find the mechanism, and at least through internet searches, all I could find was literary references, which someone's going to maybe let me borrow or take me to go to the library so I can actually check these articles out. Or I found textbooks, but as much as I like you all, I didn't feel like spending $200 on one textbook to get one answer. So if I can get access to these books, I'll find out the mechanisms. Just remind us then that nitric acid under the right conditions oxidizes only the primary alcohol in a sugar and the aldehyde, which is how we end up with one of these aldonic acids. So how many stereocenters should I write down to help focus your answer there? Well, we're talking about the configuration of one, but at that point, if we're talking about arabinose, we're dealing with three stereocenters. The reason that we're having the form of discussion that we're having right now is, what are you all going to do when you get the test question that's worded the same way? You don't have an hour to wordsmith your answer. You need to have some pat answer ready. And what I'm trying to do is help to provide you with those answers. Now, if all I get back is 30 copies of the same memorized paragraph, well, if it's correct, if I'm correct, I guess I can't mark it wrong. So, but I don't want you to just memorize. I want you to understand what's behind it. And so the reason I was asking Dante over there what kind of example to write down is, what is the point? He said it correctly. Whatever acid you have, not the sugar, because no sugars are ever meso, because they have not the same functionality on the top and the bottom of the molecule. So that's why sometimes my wording is a little much, because I want to make sure that there's no chance that you think the sugar is meso. It's the aldaric acids we're talking about. So if we're talking about these aldaric acids, though, one of these stereocenters is not up for discussion, because that was established by point one of the discussion, that the bottom stereocenter is going to be configured to the right. What is the only way that this much of the structure can be meso? if the top stereo center is also on the right. So it can't be on the right. End of point three. You know, I might have taken this many paragraphs in 20 minutes to say the same thing, but there's the answer. If one stereo center is already assumed, then the other one, you already know what it can't be. Because if it were, then it would be meso, which it can't be. Synthialdaric acid of arabidose. Is optically active. The acid cannot be meso. Since the configuration of one stereo center is presumed in an earlier step of the proof, that the configuration of another stereo center can automatically be determined, since it must avoid being meso. Or I guess I should say a meso molecule must be avoided. So that's slightly compact, but what I mean to say. Now, does anybody have any kind of questions on this third step? Because this is the easier of the last three steps. If you can get this one and get where it's easy, the other two will become easy. So not seeing any hands, how about the fourth step? Who would like to share about that one? So you and you already shared. Let's get someone else. Someone else who will also be taking the exam. Wait, that's the whole room full of you. The back two rows, what are you going to do when you have a job interview and you're forced to speak? Just consider that sometime. Someone from the front row want to take the bait? Or I guess Yun? Since you started, you said glucuric and mannaric acids are optically active, correct? Let's do the same thing we did with step three. What would you suggest as a molecule structure to write down to have a discussion around? You didn't want to give the 5-hour backstory like I did. How would you say that's what happened? So you get some situation where you start with what you know, and then you discuss about the stereo centers you're going to fill in, right? So, So we know this much of the molecule. Coming back one last time to step two. I didn't show it here, but yes, if we know something about arabinose, it is because of that connection through the Kiliani-Fisher chain extension that we also simultaneously know something about glucose. The question came up in lecture yesterday, wait, does that mean that Fisher really proved arabinose at the same time he proved glucose? Yes, and at least, I think it was 8 or 9 of the other sugars configurations. So it's not just glucose he figured out, but since glucose is blood sugar, because not all the sugars are naturally occurring, that's why this one is the one that's most heavily discussed. Also because it does have some quite interesting, tricky bits of logic to it. So if that is what we're looking at, which of the next stereocenters are we going to determine and why? So what we might term the third stereocenter, why? Yes, and that was a pretty graceful way of dealing with this issue of you have two pairs of possibilities, and you're eliminating one pair. Very simple statement to make, but as we've already discovered, you can turn that into yet another 20-minute discussion. You have to always return to the idea that glucose and mannose are epimers of each other. So you do not have the freedom to have glucose with one configuration for its third stereocenter, and mannose have the other. Both of them share the same bottom three configurations. They only differ by the top. And so what Yasmin said is very correct. Don't worry about the top configuration, since both sugars differ by it. Work on what they have in common, the three stereocenters they have in common. How does that help us? Because if we put the stereocenter, the third stereocenter on the left, then we have a situation where you potentially have a mesomolecule. Of course, that depends on the configuration of the top stereocenter. If it's on the left, which means talos, it's not going to be optically active once you oxidize. Oops. Since we're talking about the acids, not make that mistake. Make sure we are talking about an acid. So talonic acid, telluric acid, if we put it on the left, would not be meso. If we had galacteric acid, put the top stereocenter on the right, then we would be meso. Since either one, if one of those two choices is wrong, they're both wrong because they share the same three bottom stereocenters, which glucose and mannose do. So once you determine that the third stereocenter can't be on the left, you know it must be on the right, and so those three stereocenters are correct for both glucose and mannose. One other way that I tried to explain it, which was a very bad parallel, very bad example, so let me see if on the spot I can come up with another. Let's say that we're getting near lunchtime. We have four cookies, and they're presented to you in pairs. You don't know anything about the cookies except that one of them, let's turn it into a murder mystery, has been poisoned. And you may have either the pair of cookies. So you want to figure out which is the poisoned one. Because at least you can't figure out which of the two cookies is poisoned. If you know there's poison in one of the pair, you'll just throw both away and accept the pair that's fine. Again, another poor example, but it's the same type of situation. You have a pair of molecules that you're looking at, another pair of molecules. They're related because they're epimers. And so if one epimer is incorrect, because the other stereocenters are in common, the other epimer is automatically incorrect. So I have here potentially meso, And instead of writing a full sentence, I'll just do it this way. That this, meaning the one in red, stereo center cannot be configured as shown. Since both glucose and mannose have the same configuration of that center, and neither can be meso. And I think I did it again in talking just now, so in writing I'll at least correct myself. It's not whether glucose and mannose themselves are meso, it's when they're oxidized, if they are or not. So this is the fourth step of the proof. Who would like to tackle a fifth? That glucose, when you oxidize it, makes the same aldeic acid as another sugar. So let me try a slightly different approach than what we did in class the other day. In terms of a 180 degree angle, is this rotationally symmetric? In the context of doing a 180 degree rotation, is this rotationally symmetric?
No.
Because if I turn it 180 degrees, I get its opposite image, don't I? Well, then they're not rotationally symmetric because you made a new shape upon rotation. What if I had a shape like this? Is that, relative to 180 degree rotation, rotationally symmetric? Yes. Here's the exact same situation with portions of sugar shown. If we were to imagine that the top and bottoms were the same functional group, so imagine that we were dealing again with the aldeic acids, then on the left, we see one set of stereocenters that when we rotate 180 degrees, we get a different configuration. If this was the aldeic acid, it wouldn't matter which way we wrote it, because you just turn it 180 degrees again, you get back to the original molecule. But that's because the top and the bottom functional groups are the same. If, and it doesn't matter if we had a way to do this, but just presume we had a way to go back from the acid to a sugar. Well, one of these will put the carbonyl on top, turn 180 degrees around, it'd be effectively us putting the carbonyl on the bottom, which gives us two different molecules. Now look at the pair on the right. You turn 180 degrees, you get itself again. And there are one, two, three other molecules that also have this rotational symmetry. So it's not that it's the only case where only one sugar makes that acid. But the point is that, and you can presume this, that Fischer had all 16 sugars to play with and found that glucose oxidized to give the same one as something else. Since he had already determined the bottom three stereocenters, that part of it he couldn't change. So he had to look at these two cases. One that case where you made a different molecule potentially, or the acid could be made from another molecule. In another case where there's only one source of it because it has this rotational symmetry. And so, if we, again, were to put functional groups on, we see one combo gives different molecules. The other gives the same. The one that's different is glucose, which means we figured out the structure of glucose. Any questions on this last point? And I do recognize this is the most confusing of it, generally, from year to year. Yeah? One more time? Let me think if I can do it in another way. Imagine you wrote out all 16 sugars. So we have left, right, left, all of those possibilities. Oxidize them all. You're going to find that there's a couple of cases where only one molecule makes one type of acid and none of the rest can. And you'll end up with another case where there'll be more than one molecule that makes the same acid. And that's because if you had this pattern of stereocenters, for example, and don't do what I did here, but you put an acid at either end, then you could turn the molecule around and the top and the bottom would still match each other. The point is, for this case, if you put acids at both ends, rotate it, you'd end up with the same molecule again. These would be the same if they had carboxylic acids on the top and the bottom. The reason it would be the same is one is just the 180-degree rotation of the other. That's the point, that glucose, because it's not rotationally symmetric, has a cousin sugar that will oxidize to the same thing. But mannose, if you turn it, you get mannose again, as far as the stereocenters are concerned. And so again, if we're talking about the acids you oxidize, both of these are the same just to start with, and then the same after rotation. Fischer knew that mannose was the only source of mannaric acid. And so once he figured out three of the stereocenters, he knew the fourth one automatically because of that observation. Slightly different take on what I just presented a minute ago. Did that help any? What kind of sugar he had. I read about it once. I presume it's making exactly the type of hydrazone and phenylhydrazone derivatives that that I talked a little bit about in the past in class, and actually I'm going to bring up another type of hydrazone derivative called a dinitrophenylhydrazone. And so I presume that by derivatizing, he was able to identify which sugar, and that handout has some of the old ways of actually flipping the functionalities around. By making and breaking a series of lactones. Any other questions? To encourage you not to take advantage of the, let me rephrase that, to encourage you not to take disadvantage of the extra study time that you have, I will declare that Thursday in lecture will be the last day that I take questions on this topic. In other words, we'll not address this topic on Friday at all. So please make sure that you have attempted this proof before then, because the reason for delaying the test is to give you a chance to ask questions. But we have other things Friday I will plan to talk about. So last chance for questions today. Then we have a little bit left in the carbohydrate chapter, which we will finish most of today. After I scare us with a very brief trot through Chem 1C. Because we need to talk about something known as the Tollens test, which is made by taking silver nitrate and ammonia under basic conditions. Now, who remembers their qual separation scheme from 1C? Who remembers doing a qual separation scheme in 1C? Okay, we can start there. So, the very first step of that is you have these solids that you're trying to dissolve up in hydrochloric acid. The point of that was that silver, mercury, and lead precipitate when chlorides are present. So it was a way of separating out silver, mercury, lead. Once you had potentially those three precipitates, you then redissolve the silver. By adding ammonia to it. Why did adding ammonia allow the insoluble compound silver chloride to dissolve? You had no idea any of that would ever come back again, did you? Well, what happens is that which you may recognize as a transition metal complex. So silver is able to act as the center site for two ammonia ligands that turn it into a water-soluble ion, and therefore this becomes soluble again. This compound can decompose. I don't remember what the products are. I just have this recollection that silver salts over time can become explosive, some of them. So this reagent is not normally put into a bottle, but prepared freshly. But this process is done very frequently, because if you take this Tollens reagent, and we'll oversimplify it and call it just the cation, it turns out that that is a good oxidizing agent. And aldehydes, you might remember from last quarter, are able to be oxidized because that hydrogen can be eliminated. Recalling that we're doing this under basic conditions, and we can understand then how we oxidize to a carboxylic acid, but we get a salt because we're under basic conditions. We also get, and of course I realize this is not balanced stoichiometrically. Well, it is almost. We get silver solid as a product. So the Tollens test is sometimes called the silver mirror test. Because if you take, for example, a watch glass. I wonder if we have any of this. I could just do this real quick. Not right now, but. I take a watch glass, slap some acetone on it, pour a little bit of this Tollens mix on it, you'll end up with a mirror out of that watch glass because the silver metal gets deposited on the surface. This, therefore, is a qualitative test for aldehydes. So the tolerance test is often used as a qualitative way to distinguish between aldehydes and ketones. As aldehydes can be oxidized, but ketones normally cannot. Not in this kind of process. Of course, if you took a strong enough reagent, you can make a ketone oxidize, but you do so by cleaving a carbon-carbon bond and ending up again with a carbon or carboxylic acid. It means you've wrecked the molecular structure. A normal quote-unquote oxidation won't happen with a ketone. Now, I'm going to back up to something that we should have covered a little bit earlier, but I realized only in retrospect that I admitted talking about this topic. And that's how you could do a qualitative test to determine whether or not you have an aldehyde or ketone. Versus a carboxylic acid, an alcohol, some other totally different functional. So this, again, this is admittedly in reverse order. We talked about the Tollens test because we're going to come back and link that to sugars. But since I mentioned about melting points and forming derivatives, I want to back up and catch this DNP derivative. So what's DNP stand for? Stands for 2,4-dinitrophenylhydrazine. Technically, it should be abbreviated 2,4-DNP because we could have 2,5 or some other regiochemical distribution. So what does this do? We'll react it with a trace of acid and a ketone. And we make a hydrazone. And these products tend to be very, how to phrase this, easily isolatable, handleable crystals. So same reason that osmosome formation was great for carbohydrates, this is great in general for making derivatives of ketones and aldehydes. So since this kind of functional group can't form with other kinds of functional groups, this is a qualitative test for aldehydes and ketones. So in theory, you do this test first. Like this 100 years ago, we didn't have NMRs. Maybe we had IRs, but they wouldn't be on every city block. So you did a qualitative test like this. You get some yellowish, orange-looking crystal. You say, aha, I've got the DNP derivative. I've got an aldehyde or a ketone. You could then do the Tollens test to determine if you had an aldehyde versus a ketone. Unless you had something like a sugar. Because even ketoses give false positives to the Tollens test. Someone yesterday wasn't familiar with the phrase false positive. So let's say I'm a keto, a plain old keto, and I do the Tollens test, and you see at the bottom of your flask a silver mirror. That result is only supposed to happen for an aldehyde. So I'm a ketone, but I have the reactive appearance of being an aldehyde. That's a positive result. Positive meaning you see the result if you get that silver mirror. That the ketone is not supposed to react, so it's a false positive. So it means you get results that are not in line with the kind of molecule that you have. But that's because there's an exception to the Tollens test. And that's because ketoses are alpha hydroxy ketones. Can anybody come up with a reasonable explanation why you get this false positive? Ooh, just say that again a little louder. Because I have the alpha hydrogen, what does that matter? You actually have the right answer. If you could just carry it a little further. Which of these two alpha hydrogens should be more deprotonatable at the moment? Does oxygen donate or withdraw more? Electron density, that is. Is oxygen on a benzene ring an orthopaired activator or deactivator? Donate, so it effectively adds electron density, correct? And that's because of resonance. So if it has just electronegativity involved, it'd be a different story. So wouldn't that one actually be less acidic? Possibly. But what if that's not what really matters? What if because if you form an elate here, what if nothing happens? If you form an elate here, what could happen? Aren't you all supposed to Twitter your passing notes? That's the more modern way to do it, isn't it? It's what? Oh, okay. That's acceptable. What about the double tautomerization we talked about to interconvert between glucose, maltose, and fructose? Remember that discussion we had one day about mutarotation, that alpha and beta forms form an equilibrium with each other? But we also at some point talked about how you can make a double enol. Move the carbon-oxygen double bond here, and so you end up with OH groups on either side. That makes an enol. Then move the double bond here to the primary position. That's exactly what happens. In base, there is an equilibrium. Which, remember, if equilibrium can happen, will happen. So as soon as that aldehyde appears, it gets oxidized, you get the silver mirror response, even though you didn't start with an aldehyde. But that's something that only happens with these alpha hydroxy ketones because of this potential to double tautomerize. So what's the point of all of this? Well, I have brought us exactly to the same point I did in lecture yesterday, which is I don't have time to tell you. So this is going to be the cliffhanger of your little TV series. And you'll have to come back Thursday to find the answer you're dying to find out.